G'day, humans. Well, we are in the penultimate week of an election campaign in Australia in which minority parties are advertising impossible nonsense, like that they'll hold interest rates at 3% somehow. And the major parties are targeting negative ads at micro-demographics on social media, where the leaders' debate was marred by shout fests that sucked up all the oxygen in the room, the media chasing them along like obedient little toads. This is not a political episode today. It's a consciously apolitical one. This is about the deepest conversations we have with ourselves and each other, about what it means to be an individual, what it means to be part of a community, what it means to flourish and to decay. In the throes of a partisan political battle, perhaps more than ever, we need to lift our eyes and open our minds and talk to each other across the trenches, across the front line, in ways that are rational and provocative and sometimes, yes, just a little, uncomfortable. Today on the show, one of Australia's greatest Paralympians, Kurt Fernley, an amazing bloke, born with a congenital disorder that prevented fetal development of certain parts of his lower spine, which has meant that he's always been unable to walk. He has risen to the heights of athletic triumph. He focuses on long and middle distance wheelchair races. He's won medals in sprint relays as well. He participated in the 2000 Games, 2004, 2008, 2012, 2016 Summer Paralympics. He has 13 medals, 3 gold, 7 silver, 3 bronze. He's been triumphant at the Commonwealth Games. He was the Australian flag bearer at the closing ceremony of the 2018 Commonwealth Games. I mean, incredibly accomplished, and also a true humanitarian who's just channeled all of the celebrity and success that he's had into the most worthwhile causes. I won't bang on about him here. You'll hear what an incredible, insightful and thoughtful person he is. And I wanted to talk to him. I mean, the uncomfortable component of this conversation is, like, how do you talk to people who are living with a disability? Do you mention it? Do you not mention it? Like, when you relate to someone in a wheelchair, do you not quite know how to tiptoe around that? He's very blunt. He's very direct. He'll tell you how to talk. Please enjoy as much as I did, Kurt Fernley. How things been?
Busy as buggery, yeah. Busy as hell, man. Like, the world kind of opened up, right? And not only opened up, but wants everything done by June. And
yes.
And tell me about willing to push anything out past July. I think, particularly in Australia, I think we're a bit cautious to plan. Ooh, September. Let's not go that far yet.
Exactly. Who knows what's going to happen? There might be, I don't know what the next Greek letter is, but there might be another one.
Correct. I think.
Yeah.
Confidence is coming back, but it's coming back in like a hurry, you know, not in a standard confident way where you can book something 6 months away and be happy to plan it. Yeah,
no, it's frantic, isn't it? I was talking to a talkback. I was just talking to a talkback caller on the air, and she was saying, "Oh, I've just planned my." She said, "We've got a 60th high school reunion that we're planning because we haven't been able to do it the last year, and we weren't able to do it the year before, so we're finally going to do it now." And I said, "When is it?" And she goes, "We're planning it for September." And even I myself felt like I was like, "Don't you want to just do it now?" I don't know. I wouldn't be banking on September. I don't know what you know. We're all going to be inside again in September. I don't know. Let's do it. If you want to do it now. But yes, yeah, I've got.
Well, that's the reality, right?
Yeah. How did you spend the pandemic? Where were you?
I have a 220 acres just outside of Newcastle.
Oh, beautiful.
So I spent a huge chunk of that time mate, I built my own orchard fence and, you know, tables and chairs. And,
of course you did. Yeah. Of course you did.
I wish that there was a – I wish that I could have done the best reality TV show. Like, people saw me cutting down trees and stripping off bark, and I'm climbing, and I made this cubby house for my kids, and I'm dangling off a tree 2 meters high trying to put a strainer into the ground with my young fellow who was only – 3 or 4 foot. No, he was probably 4 or 5. He's handing me up a saw or a nail or a hammer, and it would have made great TV.
This is confusing. The problem with being, yeah, with being an overachiever like you, who's so self-sufficient. I just think now you just have to do everything because you don't have it in you to actually allow other people to do anything for you. If it was me, I'd just be sitting on my fat ass having a glass of lemonade or a beer and watching other people do my work for me. But you're like, I'm Kurt. I can do everything. I'm going to be lopping down the tree from 2 meters up.
You know what? I do not do nothing very well.
No. I get that impression about you.
Yeah, it.
I love doing nothing.
Well, I can do it for limited periods of time, but it's just ingrained in me that I do more when I do more. I feel that is my kind of natural state is to be moving. However, I did pick up this, I'm not sure whether you're familiar with it, but I have got a taste for gin and tonic.
I'm familiar with that particular drink. I once had a very strong taste for gin and tonic as well.
Oh, wow. Well, you know what? After racing for 25 years, I don't know. There's something, I think there might be something to this. This
gin and tonic thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a little bit too much gin and tonic, and then during the pandemic I was like, I'm either going to turn into a fat drunk or I'm going to start working out and not drinking. So now I don't drink and I'm fitter. I feel like the pandemic went that way, especially for able-bodied people, where it was like, you know, we're either just going to sit around and just indulge our worst instincts or we're actually going to get up and about. And so I've spent the first year of the pandemic putting on about 10 kilos, and then the second year of the pandemic taking 20 kilos off and cutting down on the gin and tonics.
Well, I did the exact opposite. So there you go.
There you go. You shameless drunk. Do you want to tell people who might not be familiar with you or who might not be in Australia? This is your opportunity. You can get bashful after this, but just boast for a second about what the highlights of your athletic achievements are.
I just touch on the greatest hits. I feel like this is
for the next 30 seconds. It's a long conversation.
For the next 30 seconds, this is Kurt Fernley's greatest hits. Look, I won 13 Paralympic medals, 3 of them gold. 2 of them were the marathons in Athens and Beijing in 2004 and 2008. One of them was the 5K in 2004. I podiumed on 4 consecutive times in both the 5,000 meters and the marathon in the wheelchairs from Athens all the way to Rio. Raced 72 marathons, won 42 of them, including New York, Chicago, London. Chicago and New York were five-time winners. Yeah, that's probably it. Just raced wheelchairs for 25 years and benefited greatly for your audience in the US. Benefited greatly from the culture over there that really did embrace wheelchair racing as a jewel, as something that is valued, and spent huge chunks of my life kind of learning about the professional sport of wheelchair racing while traveling around the US and Europe.
When you say it all like that, it sounds like you're really up yourself.
You jerk. You know what? Hey, so my family.
Talk about big noting yourself. I mean, have a little humility, for Christ's sake.
My family, the highest compliment in the world in our family is pretty much, you did all right. You know, you did all right, fella.
Yeah, that's right. That's very Aussie, though, isn't it?
Well, part of me does think we need more Muhammad Ali in this country. Like, we need a little bit of that confidence and that style that we don't see very often. But then we see the opposite of that, and we see those Australian champions who I love. We see Ash Barty, and there is no person in the world who I am more proud of displaying what it is to be an Australian than Ash Barty. So that just confirms to me, although inside I do think that even if it's just internally we could have a bit of Muhammad Ali, we are externally the thing that I love. We are Ash, the world number one who loves to have a beer at the cricket, who will sign off as number one because there is something in the world that she wants to do that is completely different to the glamorous, high paid lifestyle that world number one in tennis is able to give you, will turn the back on it because the lifestyle that she wants is in the other direction.
Yeah. Do you ever think about that?
Mate, I knew when I wanted to go, and it was obvious to me.
You say when you wanted to go, but you're still dangling from a tree 2 meters up, lopping logs off and doing all the charity stuff that you're doing and doing all the TV stuff that you're doing. You're not living a quiet life.
No, mate, I will never. Like I said, I think my natural state is someone that runs quick. You know, I enjoy finding a pathway and just following it as fast and as far as I possibly can. The thought of stopping anything is just not. It's not in me. I'll never retire. I retired from wheelchair racing, but alongside that wheelchair racing, there is a thousand things that I loved. In fact, the wheelchair racing was probably in the last few years, it was secondary to all the other things that were happening. It just allowed me a chance to do a few years where I could thank the people that got me to where I was. But the real enjoyment was happening outside of that already. And I could see that pathway, and it's like I wanted to be there. It's just like I had to finish a few things off before I could do it. But
it's funny that you make the difference between Australians and Americans on that as well. I mean, I've always noticed that too, that Americans, I moved to America and, you'd ask someone, oh, is the burger joint down the road any good? And they'd say, oh, my God, it's the most amazing burger. They're awesome. This is the best thing I've ever had in my entire life. And, in Australia, you could go to a 3-Michelin-star restaurant. You could go to one of the best restaurants in the world and ask an Aussie how it was. And they go, yeah, it's all right. And you go, and that means it's the best thing they've ever eaten in their entire lives. When you say that it was sort of welcome when you were in America to see the amount of, I suppose, hype or respect that they had for wheelchair racing, what did that mean to you?
Oh, mate, well, we were still over here. We were still fighting to actually get an entry to the race. The winners of the wheelchair marathons were being celebrated as, if not equal to their non-disabled peers, there was a recognition that there was a pathway that we were going on over there that celebrated the excellence of what we could bring to the table, and we were. Again, I was turning up to marathons in Australia, even in the early 2000s, told that I couldn't race. Told that that even after I'd entered, it was like this isn't for you. You're a danger. And one of the things that we really found, I think that culturally in Australia, we do disability really well. Like, we have a really robust conversation around disability, and we figure it out. But in the US, they have a Disability Discrimination Act, and that That means that if I would turn up to a marathon and they wouldn't allow me to even take part, I feel like I'd be a major shareholder of that marathon by the end of the day. Right. Or if I turned up to a flight and they said you're not allowed to enter because you're the third person in a wheelchair to check in, which is still the ability of an airline in Australia. That
really?
If I turn up, my ticket can be cancelled because I'm considered an OH&S risk, the third wheelchair.
That's occupational enter. Health and safety for non-Australians. Yeah, right. So you might endanger the other passengers with your cumbersome equipment.
I may be a danger to the staff to get me to exit that airline if there's an emergency. Even though the question is never given or asked, it's never asked, will you even need help to get off this flight in the case of an emergency?
I'm actually an Olympian, so I'm probably going to be okay. Like, I'll be dragging you guys out. I'll be lopping lumber and, helping out the flight attendants if this thing goes down.
Many, many people in wheelchairs, if it's an emergency, they will crawl and drag and do what they need to get off this flight. There will be many other people who aren't in wheelchairs who may have highly anxious lives, who may be physically in worse shape than the person with a disability is.
They might be really fat.
That could be the case. They may be more likely to have a heart attack than this, 20-year-old person in a wheelchair who is seen to be this fragile thing, but in the reality is quite robust with their approach to life, but has never actually got to define their life because this wheelchair takes over everything.
Is that a problem of cultural preconceptions, or is that a problem of like legal rules? I mean, if you didn't have occupational health and safety rules, then presumably a common sense, flight attendant or check-in agent would be able to say, "Oh, go on, get on the plane." But if they have to, abide by, we'll have to make sure that there are only, two people in wheelchairs on each flight. Then maybe that causes more problems than it helps.
I love this country. I think that we are very there is so much great about the people and the culture, but sometimes we see a rule and we don't know how to break it, even if it's the wrong rule.
Aussies love a rule.
Man,
we love a rule much more than many cultures. I mean, and people, we have this. We've successfully exported this image to the rest of the world that Aussies are these Crocodile Dundee characters who are in the outback, who are wrestling crocodiles and who don't care about anything. But you actually come here, we all drive at precisely the speed limit. We all, if a rule comes in, then during the pandemic, we don't break the rules. You don't have fights over masks on aeroplanes like they do in the States. You don't have a libertarian frontier strain. Everyone's very we all know what the rules are and we're all going to abide by them. And sometimes that can get you caught up in just a thicket of, bureaucratic nonsense. You try to call Centrelink or something and you'll wait on hold and then they'll be like, well, actually, you filled out section 14D subsection, 5 incorrectly when you added the CRN of your second child, and then that was got linked to the wrong, so now you have to go through the portal and then do this, and then you have to download the verification, the authenticator app in order to go back, and you go, oh, dumb, come on, let me live. I'm trying to live a life here. What am I doing?
Can't I just go wrestle a kangaroo? Let me be wild.
In the States, people will just blow straight through it and be like, I haven't filed my taxes in 15 years, and the IRS is too confused and bungling to even know that you haven't done it. I do find that. But so does that then redound especially poorly to you?
Well, I'll add to that when it comes to there is pockets of this country that is wild and free and amazing and crazy and you've got to hold on to your seats. It's called Far North Queensland and big chunks of Northern Territory and WA when you get into the
And there are 13 people who live there. There are only 13.
It's real wild country though.
24,000,000 999,987 people who don't live there.
Yeah, but when you go there, it's pretty fun. look, what it really comes down to is that when the US has a Disability Discrimination Act that requires the company to prove that they are not discriminating against you. In Australia, we don't have that. We have to prove that the company is discriminating against us. So that means when we take a case to try and say that we are discriminated against, we are going against multi-billion dollar companies who can afford whatever they can afford to protect their bottom line. And our airline industry in particular, it's like a protected species. That's not there are parts of that airline industry that it's not a consumer business. That is almost a national security business that you do not cross, which makes travel for people in wheelchairs just complicated in this country.
Right. And, well, we also have a duopoly where there's one huge airline that used to be owned by the government and was privatized, and then, you know, basically one major competitor. And it's also not great in the States, where they really only have four gigantic airlines and then a bunch of other smaller ones. But it's not like in Europe where you've got, you know, just a ton of different airlines. What's it like in Europe?
No, it's US and the Europe. I feel every single time I catch a plane in Australia, I feel nervous. And I am my strongest advocate, right? Like I meet the world and I like I said before, I have a very robust kind of approach to everything. But every single time I go to travel in Australia, I'm nervous that is this the time that, again, they say that I'm a third person, that they will try and take my wheelchair off me at check-in, that they will do all of these things that you've experienced over time. In the US and Europe, I have none of that anxiety. I get to travel and be a father. I get to travel and be a husband or a brother or a coworker without the anxiety that air travel in Australia particularly has on us.
Can't they just allocate the number of seats that they sell to people with special needs?
You know what, they could do 1,000 different things, but I think that they've simplified the rules, they've simplified the policy so that it can just be in and out, and it's easier to say no than to adjust. And it's been defended, and it is unfortunately of all the battles that are that's kind of been before us, whether it's my generation or the generations before, that one is still ongoing. But
and when you buy a ticket, sorry for my ignorance, but when you buy a ticket, isn't there a box that you can check saying, you know, that this person has special needs or this person is in a wheelchair or whatever? And couldn't they just say, like, if they're selling five seats like that and they know that they're only going to allow two on the plane and it's just first come, first serve, and then they're going to boot everybody else off, that doesn't seem like a system that's well thought out. Or do you not put it in when you're booking the ticket? Do they not know until you show up?
Some people may mistakenly not put it in and they just show up. I've put it in and then a week later I've had a phone call to say that you are the third person in a wheelchair that has brought this ticket. We're now 5 days away from traveling. We're going to put you on the next flight that only has one person who has clicked that button, and that is 4 days later. And I've went to do that around Christmas. My family, I had two little kids, my partner, my mum, my dad were flying on this flight. My ticket was cancelled because there was considered to be two other people already booked in. So I had to go from Newcastle, which is somewhat of a regional centre, into Sydney to fly to the destination for Christmas. And my family couldn't because we couldn't get all the tickets on there. So they got on this flight and there was not one other person in a wheelchair there. There were two elderly people who clicked on this special assistance button, yet requiring such little special assistance that it should not have qualified. But that is those interactions, and it's nonsense. It's not logical, but they're the sort of battles that people with disabilities are fighting on a day-to-day basis. And I would say that there are many occasions where people with disabilities, our lives are defined by the people that don't have disabilities, that have never had disabilities, but they look on disability and they perceive and try and get their head around what they would do if they were in this situation. Oh my God, I wouldn't be able to cope if I was in a wheelchair. I would want, you know, all the assistance in the world. And the reality is that if you all land in that situation, you do what you got to, because there is no alternative.
Also, they don't have the experience. Of course you wouldn't be able to handle it because you're an able-bodied fuckwit. Like, I've been living in a wheelchair all my life. Don't tell me what you wouldn't be able to do if you were in my position. Look at what I do in my position.
Or just ask. Be like, hey, mate, how can I help? You know, like, how can I be of assistance? How can I make this journey easy for her? And you might get the response, you know what, mate, you can make it easy. You already have, because I get to tell you right now, bugger off. You know, I'm good. I can do this thing on my own. And I always find that that's always the best way to approach it.
And so just before we get away from aeroplanes, what happens in the US and Europe if, 12 people have all booked on the same flight and they all show up in wheelchairs? Is there what happens logistically?
Well, I know that if I would turn up into the US, there is no way that I get turned back. UX actually have a great system where the first wheelchair is stored on board. The second wheelchair is potentially stored on board if there is space. Every wheelchair after that will be tagged, gate checked, put into the back of the plane, brought up on arrival, and it is smooth and amazing.
Do you have a special narrow wheelchair to get down the aisle of a plane? How does that work?
So I've actually made my chair. Every time I'd go over, there's a wheelchair manufacturer in Florida that I would spend some time with and make my chair specifically for me. And I made it so it's 7 kilos, so it's as light as hand luggage, and it deconstructs and fits in the overhead baggage. So when I'm in the US, I never even check my chair in. In Europe, I never even check my chair in. I fly down the aisle, I throw the chair in the overhead baggage, and I am on my way. And I made it that way because of the I was hoping that I could try and do something similar in Australia, but there's just no space for that.
So the counter argument against laws like America's is, I know people who have tried to set up, little restaurants in California, or they've wanted to expand a little bit, and then there's this thicket of regulations that they have to go through. So there are fire codes that are very onerous. There's this, there's that, and one of them is the Americans with Disability Act, which a lot of small business people whinge about because they'll go, all I wanted to do was just extend out onto the pavement here so that people could sit out there. But in order to do so, I'm going to need to build a bloody great wheelchair ramp that goes all the way around, and I don't have the money to do that, and it's not actually necessary. But again, coming back to the rules are the rules, and you're going to have to, well, what if someone who was, who was severely handicapped was trying to come in, and then they're like, what do we need? Do we need to build a big slingshot to be able to fly them up and, a hole in the roof to be able to, and a trampoline and everything? Come on, I'm just trying to have a cafe here. This is too difficult. What do you say to those people?
Oh, look, if we're all annoyed at each other a little bit in community, we're probably doing something right. And I say that because, like even in the disability community, I run over the little dots for those who are visually impaired on the roads, and it shakes my kidneys. And I find it pretty bloody tough to push, the bumps that are there.
Yeah, in Australia, there are little ridges, little raised ridges along the pavement, the sidewalk, so that people who are visually impaired don't walk straight onto the road. They can feel it on their feet, right?
Correct. Some amputees may not like the fact that there are long ramps to get up to get into a building. They may prefer that there is actually steps. It's easier. There is this acceptance that we're going to go through a bit of difficulty to make sure that everybody gets to have a bit of an experience in life. And I know that that is frustrating sometimes to be able to sit down and take on the complex world of disability. But when you get through that annoyance, it stops the absolute disruption of that person's entire life. Not a frustration. It is an absolute disruption. If I turn up to a space and I can't get through, it's not an annoyance. It often means I've got to go home. Or if I turn up to a space and my children who are non-disabled, if they can enter into the space and I can't be a father past that point, then my life is not defined to me, but it's defined to my kids that their father is less. And my partner, or if it is my coworker, or if it is my junior in my workspace. So we are talking about things like regulation as a frustration, and I completely understand that it is a frustration because there is this really complex thing that we're trying to create regulation to bring in, and it does get messy in there. But again, we're not dealing with the frustration to help another person's frustration. We're doing it to stop somebody from completely being excluded from a life experience. And and I think a bit of frustration is actually worth doing to get through to that point. And once done, usually it's done. Like it is finished. Rather than it being a barrier forever, once you've invested the time and energy to create a space that is accessible to everyone, that's accessible to everyone forever.
That particular space is, but everything else that then subsequently needs to be done also needs to comply with the rules. Like there's a, I read a big piece, I think it was in Esquire or Vanity Fair, about this couple who, or the New Yorker or something, there's a couple in California who've taken it upon themselves to be disability rights litigators. And they'll go around to they'll call a place in advance and they'll say, oh, you know, we have unique needs. The place will say, yep, of course we comply with the Americans with Disability Act. And they go around, they're a married couple, and they'll show up at a place and then they'll start measuring exactly, you know, how far it is. Something. And if it's a millimeter out, then they stage some sort of upset. You know, one of them will fall over or one of them will drop a glass or something like that. Then they've got the same high-flying lawyer and they sue these small businesses and the small business and they go around and they think they're doing God's work, basically, because they're making sure that compliance is up to scratch. But, of course, you know, the small businesses are saying, look, if you need us to comply to the letter, then the regulator themselves should be, I don't know, doing spot checks and just helping us to make sure that we're complying, because if you read the, you know, 100 pages of the legislation, we're not going to get every single little thing right. But instead of just being given a tap on the shoulder and say, hey, can you fix this, can you fix that, they're having to pay lawyers to go to court and they're ending up being bankrupted because then there are these $10 million, you know, payouts and all this sort of jazz from the emotional trauma from when the person dropped the cup because, the thing was 1 millimeter out to code. And the backlash then is from people saying, oh, this whole thing is bloody stupid. If you have special needs, then that's unfortunate, but life sort of sucks for everybody. Everybody's got particular challenges. And if you can't do this, then, well, I can't do that either. So you got to sort of suck it up and cop it.
Well, bring that on. Like, let's have that conversation and let's see who wins the battle in the court and in that common square. And the point that you make is kind of like the point on everything, that those two individuals say, if they are going around and they are measuring millimeter by millimeter, they've probably seen a politician talking about how they want to reduce the Disability Discrimination Act, that we need to get rid of regulation. And because they see somebody going to the far, the fringe on that way, we see this push towards the other direction. And does that allow to be, you know, bring the middle closer to where it should be? Or does it just create a fight that will continue to go and just cause disruption and distrust? And, you know, I personally think that we need people to push barriers. We need people to push in a direction and then you allow people to go into the middle space and figure something out in there. How do you reckon that would go in Australia, though? Like, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think we're just generally, thank goodness, a bit less extreme on everything than Americans are. You know, you can take any measurement that you want, and that has good upsides. You know, the civil rights movement of the 1960s was more fierce in America, and it put an end to Jim Crow. I mean, their political system is more extreme. You know, someone like Obama could never have become the leader of a parliamentary democracy like Australia, but someone like Trump also couldn't. So you take the good with the bad, and I just think they get, you know, the culture wars at the moment in terms of, their cancel culture and their hysteria around, gender pronouns or whatever it might be, and then the backlash from the right on, like, banning school books that mention gay parents and stuff. There's just a lot more roiling kind of antagonism over there, which I think we don't have, thankfully. But I think you're right that to put your finger on the fact that, you know, each extreme then empowers the other extreme. And I think when you're talking about your life and your ability, as you say, to be a father to your kids and your ability to just participate in civil society, then the last thing you want to do is turn that into a toxic. I mean, it's the same with, like, LGBTQI plus issues and stuff like that, and, you know, transgender in transgender people in sports and stuff, like the more it becomes a political football for the bystanders to argue about, the worse it sort of is for everybody. And if we can turn the temperature down a bit and just have technocratic wonks figure all this stuff out and remove ourselves from the debate, then I think the better we end up being.
See, a part of me also wonders, though, when it comes to particularly if we're talking about small business, say, I think it was 1991, in Australia we had a prime minister called Bob Hawke who said that every building will be accessible to every person, every child that wishes to enter it in 10 years. Now, business could have started, every business could have started putting money away to start to prepare for this regulation. Instead, 9 years later, everyone was terrified and it was pushed out another 10 years and then another 10 years. Right. And now we're still sitting here going past places that are not accessible. Like, when are we going to stop fighting a battle as if it's in the moment and start actually recognizing that this is something that we should have been doing for four decades.
So what is the law now, Kurt? Is there, I mean, pardon my ignorance, but I assumed that there would now be some kind of public accommodations requirement that if you are a public, if you're open to the public, that has to be accessible to everybody. Is that not the case?
Walk down the street and see how many shops that you pass that have steps in front of it. Yeah. Like, as soon as you start seeing it, you know. Mm. And I think that it is like a company has to make reasonable adjustments and has to be, but the accountability side of that just is not there in Australia. So we do see in the US, you do see those far flung stories of just what seem to be completely unreasonable interactions with community, but dear bloody God, that makes my life easier.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, Americans like to, again, this is almost like the flip side of the illusion that Australians have been able to export about themselves. Americans have been able to export this idea about themselves that they're capitalist and, they're raw in tooth and claw and, they're a place that is the least sort of socialistic of all the Western democracies. But in actual fact, when you live there, I mean, if you go to a post office, it feels like you're in the Soviet Union. If you go and try to get your driver's license renewed, it feels like you're in Moscow in the 1950s. You know, there are these incredibly heavily unionized industries, especially government bureaucracies, where people walk at the pace of an obese sloth to go from one filing cabinet to another. That's the downside of it. And then on the upside of it, you do have these very, very strict rules about stuff like that that does make people's lives easier. And here may be part of our sort of, I don't know, part of our attitude towards things. I can't really reconcile Australians' obedience with our lack of willingness to put rules in place to make the life of people like you easier. But certainly in America, it's not the case that America is just this freewheeling, let it go, business can do whatever it wants to, kind of corporate paradise.
Yeah, it does my head in a little bit too. I love that joint. That is, the US is so complicated and it is such a, in Australia we might paint a picture. It's like the US paints this picture and it is expanded on every edge where it includes so much just intensity in everything that it does. And over the last couple of years, it's the first couple of years that I haven't been there since 93. And yeah, there is just so much about that place that I think is entertaining and out there and full of energy, but there is also a hardship there that is like out of control as well.
And, totally. I've seen poverty in the States that's unlike anything I've seen anywhere in the world, including in the developing world. Because in the developing world, at least everyone is sort of on the same. You know, you walk through a slum in Mumbai and at least everybody, that's their life and they're operating within a context. I mean, it's awful, but they're operating within a context in which things are set up for them to be able to function somewhat. Their community functions in that, at that state of development and that state of resources. And their families still stay together and their lives still move on. But in places where Western civilization has just broken down altogether, like, I mean, I went on a drive through New Orleans not long after it was demolished by the hurricane, and about 18 months later, and there are people living in conditions where there's a total breakdown of family, community, law and order, structure. It's chaos. It's like something, it's like something I've never seen in Africa or Asia. But
whenever you travel, I think that disability tells a really interesting story, like a really complicated story. Like, I've crawled into places where you have to crawl in to get in there. And the experience with disability is one of the most challenging things that I've ever seen. Like, right now, wherever you zoom into, whatever part of the world, you go into the most, hidden, challenging, tiny little village in some, country that the tourist track misses. No matter how vulnerable a community gets, there's always a person with a disability there, exponentially more vulnerable, sitting in the dirt. And we have this huge variation of existence now. The gold medals of the Paralympic Games, where we are the third biggest multi-sport event in the world, built over the last 60 years. And then our community, well, two-thirds of the world who require a wheelchair don't even have one, So yeah, we have this really progressed community that is kind of leaving another one behind. And so it's a really challenging part of this world.
What places have you crawled into?
Mate, I've crawled into the ones that I've crawled into is there's a township, a community in it's called Makuru, just on the outskirts of Nairobi. There's a couple of little grade schools in there where the Rubin Centre that educates 1,800 children that has a lot of Australian, and there were US donors. And I've got about 80 kids with disabilities in there in the Kurt Fernley Centre. And it was one of the, like when the US, we saw foreign aid be cut in, I think it was 2017, and months after that, you see just the flower coming from USAID stop, like we see this tiny little percentage of our GDP reduced out of foreign aid. And then you see 80 or 100 or 1,800 children just stop getting a meal. I've crawled into PNG, where Papua New Guinea, which is, it's a 3-hour flight from Australia, but it's one of the hardest communities, that I've seen. I've not crawled into, but been invited into Yarmouk refugee camp in the years before it was flattened, and met with teachers and principals to encourage the participation and to highlight the need to have all variation of child within their classroom, that these children can't be isolated with mum and dad, because an isolated childhood means to an isolated and a life means to an early death, means to a greater risk of marginalization and predatory behavior on them. And whenever I find out about a program that's doing great stuff in education or wanting to bring kids with disabilities into education, I try and do whatever I can to, if I can play a part, I will. I am a teacher, I'm a high school teacher, and I grew up crawling around the bush in Karkul. It's right in the central part of New South Wales in Australia. And even in Australia, we have huge isolation. Like we talk about how the majority of people, by far, we're 25 million people, you say, and 24 million of them are in metropolitan centres around the coast. If you go inside, like I grew up, there was no concrete. There was no asphalt or bitumen. I grew up crawling for the first decade of my life. And I was valued and welcomed as I was You know, like I was welcomed into the community. Crawling around my school, there was no hesitation. There was no awkward looks. I was in a school of 16 people and they were all my family. And they loved me and they welcomed me. And I felt like I could be who I was. But there was an isolation in the fact that my hands are in the dirt and everybody else was walking around. And still to this day, there are huge chunks of my community that are still in the dirt and will not be able to leave it unless there is just a complete, well, the reality is that when I go and work in these spaces is that I know I can't, like, it may not change for everybody and there may be people still crawling around in the dirt isolated in 100 or 200 years from now. But when you go into these spaces, you accept that you can do whatever you can do to change that one moment. Mm. And I love that. That's being.
When you say, Kurt, when you say there are huge chunks of your community and use that term community, I'm interested in that because when did that sense of you being, I guess, a representative of a community evolve? Like I always have difficulty with that community. So like I'm married to a guy and my husband will, he'll talk about, you know, the LGBTQI plus community and he'll be including in that, you know, some genderqueer person on the other side of the world who we've never met, who has nothing in common with us. I have much more in common with my straight work colleagues and my friends here than I do with that person. You know, my grandparents were also Holocaust survivors, and so they were very passionate about their Jewishness and about the legacy of, you know, oppression that our people have suffered for thousands of years. And I also think, you know what, I don't like what Israel has become. I don't like what they're doing. I don't really feel any affinity for the Jewish community. I mean, I'm ethnically Jewish, I guess, but I mean, I don't want to think about that community because I have much more in common, I think, with, you know, someone who's struggling in Palestine, just emotionally, just empathically, than I do with like world Jewry. And so I'm not crazy about like community when it's used as a way of trying to force us into kind of tribes who are competing over the scraps of a finite pie. I'd much rather sort of think about us as individuals and trying to come together and have and find whatever common ground we can. But obviously there's a utility in people thinking about community because otherwise, you know, communities who suffer unique problems don't have anyone to speak on their behalf apart from people inside their quote unquote community. When did you start using that term? How does it relate to you?
A couple of moments that I think enhanced it. One of them was when, so I grew up not seeing any other person with a disability until I was 12 or 13. There were no people in wheelchairs at my school. Like I said, I was in a school of 16 people for the first 6 years, 7 years, and then high school, it was to a school of 300 people, but still I just did not see anyone in a chair unless I was at a hospital and then they were sick. And I thought, well, I must be the only person in a wheelchair that's not sick. And then I found the Paralympic world, and our first Paralympian, Australian Paralympian, is Uncle Kevin Coombs. He's an Indigenous guy, and we all know him as Uncle, and we knew all of the other first Paralympians as uncles and aunties, and they welcomed us into the community, and they built us, you know, like they taught me what it is to be a person in a wheelchair. I remember Michael Callahan, and he was a wheelchair basketball player for the Australian wheelchair basketball team. He saw me come out and he grabbed me in the chair and he said, get rid of those handlebars and get rid of those brakes. And I'm 12 and he says, nobody should push you. Only you choose where you go and how you go. And I went home and I hacked them off with a hacksaw. And then Jeff Adams, a wheelchair racer, world champion out of Canada, he allowed me to live in his house for a month on end to learn what it is to be a wheelchair racer. Louise Savage, Australia's greatest Paralympian, she would pick me up at the airport when I would fly on a regional airline down to Sydney or the train station. She would feed me and she would just give me a taste of what the life was like that I was entering into. Chantelle Petitclerc from Canada, Tenny Gray Thompson from the UK. If that's not community and family, I don't know what is. And then when I started to work with disability in the developing world, I will crawl into that Makuru township with 2 million people, and I will crawl past, you know, 1,000 people, and I will sit in the house of a kid with a disability who will look at me, and that child will have as much hunger and desire as I've ever had. And that kid sees me as their family because it's the first time that they have seen somebody in the world that looks like them. And I was there. And I was there when I was 12 years old. So when I think about community, this is my family, because there is as much care and love and support in that community as I have felt from my extremely loving and caring mother and father and brothers and sisters. And isn't that what we do with our brothers and sisters? Like, we look at them and we have a care and an understanding of where they want to be and who they want to be. And that is the exact same feeling that I felt when I was 12 with Uncle Kevin, or 18 with Jeff Adams, or 21 with Tenny Gray Thompson, who is the UK's greatest Paralympian as well, or when I was 29 sitting in one of the towns on the Kokoda track looking at a kid that had a desire to have more in his life and saw it for the very first time when I was sitting next to him looking back. So If it's not community, I don't know. I don't know if there's a word there that better describes it.
And what was the community like in the town where you grew up? You mentioned Kahor. You were this is about 50 k's from Bathurst in the central west of New South Wales, a town of what, it has a couple of hundred people now. I don't know how many people it had back then.
201, probably.
That's right. Yeah, they're rueing the day they lost you, mate. They're like, we had it so good until he buggered off. What were things like when you were like in primary school, when you're 5, 6, 7? How were you getting around? You say you were crawling around. Were you literally crawling around? Did you have a wheelchair? What was, who were your friends? What was it like?
Yeah, I had I had a wheelchair. I got a wheelchair when I was about, I got my first wheelchair when I was 4 or 5. And I threw it in a gully at home because it was a gully is like a, I don't know.
A ditch.
It was a ditch. Yeah, because it was no good. It was no good. Like, it was the biggest wheelchair that I'd ever seen. It's bigger than any wheelchair I've had since. But it was just a wheelchair. Give him a wheelchair and that'll do. And that was no good for a 4 or 5 year old kid. I wanted to be crawling. I wanted to be moving. I wanted to feel like I was a sibling to my brothers and sisters. I wanted to be a neighbor. I wanted to get my hands dirty, you know. And we lived in a house that wasn't accessible. No, that's a terrible. That's a funny thing to talk about.
The Californian Americans with a Disability Act wheelchair ramp had not yet been installed on every home in Kakor.
Well, mum and dad, they were not. My dad was a labourer, and my mum was looking after 5 kids, and the ability to make home upgrades was just wasn't on the cards. But we had concrete for about 10. Maybe 15 metres from the front door to the front gate. So that was all that the wheelchair would go to. If I wanted to go past that, I crawled, and so I crawled. I did, when I got into school, I started to use my wheelchair a bit more. The principal actually did concrete a lot of paths around the school. In 1985, I was welcomed into Kakor Public at the objections of the Department of Education at that point in time. In 1985, again, every country's on its own journey when it comes to disability, but in 85, I was still meant to be segregated and isolated in special education or institutionalization. They would sit
really?
Down.
Even though you're cognitively exactly the same, you're not allowed to learn. You're not allowed to learn with other kids.
There was a meeting in my mother and father's kitchen where they wanted to transport me to Orange daily for school. And my mother and father couldn't afford to transport me daily in there.
How far and was they, Orange?
Orange is only about 50 minutes to an hour away, but every right. single day. Like I said, we were living in
2 hours round trip. Yeah, just picking up.
Yeah. So that wasn't an option. They offered institutionalization so I could actually stay there. But my principal on that same day walked into my mum and dad's house and he said that my mum and dad needed to ignore that conversation. He would take me into that school. He would then concrete parts of me so I could get around the school. I think of it as the ramp is the artery that got me around the school. Once I got to the point, I crawled. That was my capillaries. You know, that was the way that I would engage once I got to that space. But he cemented that school in the Christmas holidays out of his own money. He rebelled against his bosses because he knew it was right. It took them 6 months to find out that I was actually in the school. By that stage, I was welcomed and I was a value part of the school. So they're not going to take me out. Mm. So from there, I was just valued and welcomed whatever way I wanted to get around. I would crawl and do the cross country. I did high jump and long jump by just crawling and throwing my body. I grew up in the 80s, but it was probably more a 1950s style of growing up in the story of disability. Like there would have been advocates in the US demanding for universal accessibility into public spaces where I was still falling out of trees and, you know, picking peas out of poo.
What an amazing principle.
Matt, in general, I will meet the world as I need to get through it. And I do think that many people with disabilities, we have this ability to adjust and adapt because we've had to. Like that is just, we've lived in a world that is often not made for us. And so it is adjust, adapt, or not engage. And not engaging isn't an option. So there are, what I believe, there are a lot of lessons that disability can bring to every room, every space. And in particular, I lean into it big time.
That principle, Kurt, I meant the principle. Principal, P-A-L, the guy who...
not the I principal, took it as a compliment. The ego's back. There you go.
There you go. Big note yourself again. Bloody English language with too many... What's that called? I think it's called a metonym. Is it? What's that word that sounds like another word? Anyway, it's a good principle, but he was also a good principal, the bloke who, to stand up against the institution and go, we're not gonna ship him off. You know, we're gonna find a way to make this work. That to me, that is my aspiration for the way that the world gets out of all of the disagreement and strife that and misunderstandings that we have, that we could find a way. He's not a member of your community. He's used his reason and his mind and his empathy, and he's sat down probably in a quiet moment after everyone's gone home one day, and he's thought to himself in his principal's office, what do I do here? And he's listened closely to his heart and his mind, and he's gone, it doesn't matter that I haven't had this life experience. I know what needs to be done here. And that kind of cross-community empathy, that cross-community reason, that kind of standing up for people on the basis of what is right and what is logical instead of getting embroiled in tribal warfare, that is sort of what I was pointing to as to being an aspirational goal. Not to demean the utility of feeling like you're in a community, but, you know, he had bugger all to do with your community and he still stepped up and did the right thing.
Yeah, well, I think the actual problem happens when we do put our flag in the ground and say that we are only in this community. You know, that's where I see problems. Like I'm not just in one community. He is in my community. he is in my family, that other part of my family. Like even in my family, like my literal family, we're a big family. There's five siblings in mine, but my dad had 10 kids. My dad was one of 10 kids. They all had big families all around it. So they are in 100 different communities. I reckon that even in my community, we're five kids, we probably vote five different ways. But I love them more than anything in the world. Yeah. But they don't just have to be in my community. They don't just have to be. I want them to be in 100 communities. I hope my family. And I think when we plan our flag and say that I am just in this community right here, this is the one-dimensional approach to life that I'm going to take, I think that there is danger there, huge amounts of danger there. And that's where we need to avoid that, I think.
It's a homonym, by the way. Principle, a word that sounds like another word. It just popped into my head. It's not a metonym. It's a homonym. Welcome back to Words with Kurt and Josh, where we teach you all of the obscure linguistic terminology.
It's just me being up myself, mate. That's all it is.
Principle. They're homonyms. They're words that sound like other words but have different meanings. Kurt, I don't want to keep you forever. It's delightful to talk to you, and I could talk to you all day. What would you say to people who are listening, either able-bodied people or people who are in wheelchairs or in the spirit that you've just articulated of being able to reach across boundaries and try to sort of, you know, heal each other? And, you know, why don't you talk to the person who's listening to this, who's able-bodied, who thinks, that all sounds fantastic. I'm totally on your side. Good on ya. Paralympics, rah, rah, rah. But at the end of the day, you know, life cuts us all different breaks. And if you have the misfortune to be born with special needs, then your life is just by necessity going to be tougher than other people's. Some people are born dumb. Some people are born into poverty. Some people are born with genes that make them really fat. We don't bend over backwards and reshape our entire societies to accommodate each other. Life works best when it's kind of every man for himself, and you do what you can to be nice to each other. But at the end of the day, the chips fall where they may, and them's the breaks.
Some people are born assholes. I don't expect to win 100% of people, and I will never try and convince that person. I will happily go on and live my life, and I will make sure that when I get in to have this argument in the field of public opinion in the town square, I will say that I believe that we are a better place when we're looking out for each other. I believe that we are a better place when every single person gets to buy in to what it is to be an Australian, or what it is to be a functioning, valued member of whatever community is over there. And there are going to be people who disagree with me. Mate, I get messages on social media that say that I shouldn't fund a program that supports disability because your parents didn't abort you. I get that. I'm not going to change that person's mind, nor do I really want to. Nobody gets 100% of people agreeing with them. I will happily thank them for their contribution and let them get on their bloody way. In the meantime, I'm going to turn around to the other 99% of people that I believe are reasonable, that I believe are caring, that I believe can actually join and do something good. The other guy, nice to meet you.
What's the easiest and simplest thing that people can do, that the 99% can do?
You know what? I think that the best thing that you can do when you see someone with a disability, ask him for a coffee. Get to know him.
Offer him a coffee rather than ask him to buy you a coffee, which would probably be a little bit impolite. Excuse me. Have you got change for
a coffee?
It's very expensive in Sydney at the moment. The baristas are overcharging so much.
I would just say that bring people of all variation into your life, not as a token thing. Actually invest in the people around you and make it a meaningful, substantial relationships over a long period of time. Don't query them. Don't pepper them with questions. Just invite them into your world, whether it be a coworker, whether it be a person that lives around the corner. I think we've got to go back. If I learn anything from COVID, we've got to have real communities again. We've got to have real conversations, real communities. And don't be fearful of disability. Don't slap the kid's hand away when they point at somebody in a chair or somebody with Down syndrome. Talk to them about it. Don't make it a fearful interaction.
let's just touch on that before I let you go, because part of the reason why people might not offer to buy a coffee from someone who they encounter is this sense of self-consciousness or awkwardness, or like they don't want to do the wrong thing. If there were no holds barred and they were being completely honest, then they might be, come on, mate. And when they're having the coffee, they might be like, what's it like having no legs? Or what's it like, you know, whatever it is. But they can't say that. They can't. And you don't know whether or not that person doesn't have the obligation to tell you for the 7 millionth time what it's like not to have any legs or whatever it might be. But the sort of self-consciousness, you know, your asshole puckers up and people get a little bit sweaty and clammy and they're like, I don't really know how to behave around this person because I don't want to put my foot in it and I don't want to say the wrong thing. How do you bridge that?
Get to know the person rather than get to know the disability. So get to know the person. Like you would be sitting down at any other person, and I don't mean buy them a coffee and then walk away. I mean, you know, if there is somebody in your community that has a disability, get to know them. The disability is secondary. You'll learn more about the disability by never asking about it. It will just come up. I have never, and it's really weird coming from within the community to then take a job, say, in the media and interview people, or even see the interviews of people with disabilities, because I have never sat down with somebody in my team and asked them what their disability is, not in 25 years. Yet all the media that I see, the first question is, what's your disability? Excuse me, Josh, of course. you know, like it's very interesting to see that interaction and to see it be awkward, but I would just say get to know the person. And I've got two non-disabled kids, and every time I pick them up at daycare or kindergarten, I will have a press conference with this big mob of little kids that run around me and go, why are you in a wheelchair? What's wrong with that person? And I'll answer them in a positive way to make sure that they get comfortable and never feel awkward around disability. We need people from when they're 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old to just look at this thing, ask their question, be comfortable, move on, and learn in a calm and friendly way.
I have a friend, one of my good friends, has a congenital birth defect, which has one of his limbs be too small. One of his arms is small. And when we first met, it was actually my partner who met him first. Some years later, he said, why didn't you ever ask me about my arm? And my partner didn't really know what to say, because I guess he thought that it would be impolite. But the bloke actually found it more impolite that people
really
pretend not to notice it. Yeah, he found it like after a while, it was like, there's this elephant in the room. Why do I have to bring it up? Like, aren't you sort of curious? Like, why are you pretending not to see it in a way? Does that contradict your thing about get to know the person? I mean, we're talking about, you know, not on first meeting, but after once you're friends, then just never bringing it up.
Again, it's hard to ever speak. When you speak about a group, every individual is going to have their own approach. And like I said, I have a very very unique experience with disability. When you're born with it, it may be different should you acquire it through trauma. If I was asked that, why didn't you ever ask me about, I would just go, it never came up.
Yeah, right.
You know, it just didn't come up. My sisters and brothers, they introduce me to people and they go, and I've seen their friends go, hey, he's in a wheelchair. You didn't tell me that. Like, it just, I personally find it doesn't come up. I don't ask people, I don't know, maybe it's a... There's a normality now that I have around it, that I've experienced so much variation of disability that when I sit down there, it's just kind of.
It's not like you sit down with someone and you go, you know, why are you so fat? Or like, you know, when did you lose your hair? If you're talking to someone who's bald, you know, you just don't. Yeah, it does. It shouldn't be the first. There shouldn't be the leading thing about them. Kurt, you're a national treasure. It's lovely to talk to you. Thank you for making time for us.
No probs, mate. It's been fun.
Uncomfortable Conversations is produced by Stefan Postuma. Follow me, Josh Sepps, on Twitter and Instagram for all the latest. May your day be fruitful, your mind humble, your enemies generous, and your conversations perfectly, sparklingly, delectably uncomfortable.